Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to the programme, wherever you are, however you're listening. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half with Unbelievable, the show that brings together Christians and non-Christians for discussion and debate every week. And we're really looking at one of the issues that has been at the forefront of this programme for the last few years today, the new atheism. You're unbelievable. Today we're asking the future of atheism. Is it a bold new world? Of course, the new atheism has been around, I would say it launched when Richard Dawkins published The God Delusion 4 years ago. He and others, including Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett and Sam Harris, have been at the vanguard of the new atheism. Well, we're asking today, is it a bold new world? What is the future for it? Alistair McGrath joins me. He's a theologian and philosopher at King's College London. He's author, of course, of the best-selling book in response to The God Delusion, The Dawkins Delusion. He's going to be in conversation today with Caspar Melville, who's editor of New Humanist magazine, also CEO of the Rationalist Association. And we'll be asking, are the new atheists historically naive? What is the future of atheism? And why does Alistair McGrath believe that atheism is in its twilight years? All questions we'll be addressing and hearing your feedback to on today's programme, Unbelievable. Well, thank you, gentlemen, both for joining me in the studio today. It's a great pleasure to have you both. Alistair, you have featured before, so thanks for joining me today. Also, Caspar, your first time on the programme. I hope not the last. Who knows? We may see you again, depending on how it goes today, I suppose, whether we scare you off or whether you come back for more.
I'll try and perform well.
We're talking about the future of atheism. My question is it a bold new world? Let's get a bit of introduction to you both. Be interested to start with you, Alistair. Many people will know you, obviously, for your role in defending Christian faith, particularly the Dawkins Delusion was something of a bestseller in response to the God Delusion. But has faith always been a part of your life, would you say?
No, it hasn't, or at least it might have been. I'll qualify that in a moment. I mean, I really began as an atheist. I was absolutely convinced when I was younger that science disproved God and that if you believed in God, you were a kind of demented idiot. You were a loser. You're on your way out. And in fact, when I read Richard Dawkins, I feel a little bit nostalgic because I used to be like that many years ago. Was there a faith? Well, I think looking back on it now, I would say it is. For me, at least certainly that kind of atheism does involve going beyond the available observable. And therefore, I'd actually want to suggest, perhaps controversially, that certain forms of atheism really are faiths themselves. But when I went up to Oxford to study science in more detail, I think I really had to review things in a very big way. And that, I think, moved me decisively away from atheism to Christianity. I mean, it was really a discovery, a moment of illumination for me. And I've kind of always stayed that way ever since, although obviously I've kind of hope I've become deeper in my thinking since then. But certainly in terms of the fundamentals, I'm pretty much where I was back in 1970 to 1971.
Sure. I mean, over time, your views have developed, I'm sure. Your sort of thinking has become refined. But essentially, at the core of it, do you feel like you, in a sense, were argued intellectually into a belief in God?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, my conversion, if I can use that word, was purely intellectual. It wasn't a question of emotional need or imaginative deficit. It was much more, hey, this seems to make more sense of things than what I used to believe. You know, this looks good. And I think since then, I've kind of gone deeper and discovered there are indeed relational, emotional, imaginative dimensions of faith. But that wasn't what drew me in. And therefore, for me, the cognitive aspects of faith, the fact that it makes sense in itself and makes sense of things, really is very important to me. So I may not be typical at all in that respect, but that's the way it is.
Well, we'll find out more about what your thoughts are on the new atheism, because it's an area you've devoted quite a lot of time to recently. Also joining us, as I say, is Casper Melville. Casper, you're editor of the New Humanist magazine. How can people get hold of that if they want to get hold of a copy?
Very straightforwardly. Well, there are two ways. You can go into WH Smith or to newsagent and buy a copy. They were only in 1,300 stores countrywide. We're quite small. Or even easier is to go online, www.newhumanist.org.uk. You can see the kind of thing we do. You can order a free copy online. You could subscribe straight away. You can donate money to the charity that produces it. But certainly that's a good way for, presumably many of your listeners might just want to have a look at it as a kind of example of something rather than something they might want. But, I would encourage them to come and
have
a look.
Well, there are many atheists who listen to this program via podcast, so I'm sure that would be...
I would hope so. So atheists do come and visit.
For them to be interested in as well. But, I mean, is the phrase humanist one that you have always taken for yourself, or was it one that you discovered at some point in your life?
Well, it's a difficult one, this, in terms of the variety of different descriptors in our field. No, the answer to that is no. I never knew I was a humanist. Perhaps arguably until just before I got my job at New Humanist, and when I started to think, it wasn't something I self-identified as any more than really as an atheist or as a secular person. It was just part of my reality, my everyday reality. So I describe myself... I mean, I'm an atheist in the sense that, not that I know that God doesn't exist, but I have no persuasive evidence that he does exist that anything called God does exist. Therefore, on the balance of probabilities, I'm an atheist. Maybe I'm an agnostic in that strict sense.
In the strict sense, even Richard Dawkins would say, it's impossible to prove the negative of God.
Well, Dawkins has said that. Many people caricature him as someone who says that, science can prove that God doesn't exist, which clearly, as a scientist, he knows is not the case. You can't prove the non-existence of something.
But he would say on the balance of probabilities.
Exactly, and I'm persuaded by that argument. The likelihood to me is so infinitesimal that I proceed on the basis, I don't make Pascal's wager, that it, in the end, maybe it'd be better if I acted as if God existed, so that if I did discover that happened when I died, I'd still get a place in heaven or whatever. No, I'm not concerned about that. And as a humanist, where the humanism comes in is that's the positive content which is laid on top of the living your life without God. Is I'm someone who bases my values on my shared life with my fellow humans, my idea that life is, this is the only life I get to live. I want to live it as well as possible. I want to make it a good life for myself and for others. I have a responsibility. It's the positive ethical content, which really is something that I think I had when I was younger, but I never really thought about as in relation to humanism.
I mean, you say you never really, and this was from an article that I read that you had written, thought about religion, had any cause to think about religion. You didn't grow up in any sense a religious household, nor was it a dramatically atheistic preaching household. But it was the terror attacks of September the 11th that made you realise that religion is something you have to have an opinion on.
I think this is something I share, as it were, with the birth of new atheism. We'll talk about that in a minute. But in many ways, the 9/11 attacks was the moment for the secular West when, for people who didn't think very much about religion, a kind of religious threat appeared. Now, we know it was to do with Islam. We know that it wasn't all Muslims doing this. We know, there were lots of ways to minimize it. But it was a very strong statement of a new aggressive form of religion. And it went hand in hand, not that, it wasn't a plot, but around the same time were emerging other very sort of public-facing forms of religious belief. Very, very strong. I mean, I'm thinking in particular of American creationism, well-funded, which was arguing for alternative visions to evolution to be taught on the school curriculum. In fact, won that argument in certain ways before it was slapped down. Other things like Scientology and other forms of belief, with their big film stars and these things were suddenly back on the agenda in a very big way.
Absolutely. I mean, in a way, the new atheism, as the term has come to be coined, has really developed in a big way since those September the 11th attacks. I mean, Alistair, before we came on air, we were discussing where this term new atheism came from, but wherever it came from, it represents a certain brand of, you could say, more dogmatic atheism, represented obviously in the writings of people like Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, these so-called four horsemen of the apocalypse. But what do you make of it? Would you put something like September the 11th as being?
Oh, absolutely. All historical research suggests that this was a precipitating moment for the new atheism. Sam Harris said, "I began to write my book on the 12th of September." You can see immediately that was a very defining moment for them. I don't think the phrase "new atheism" is helpful because as I read their books and the other books, I've seen this all before. You know, there's nothing really new here. What I think is a new intensity. I think that is true. I regret the new aggressiveness because I don't like aggressive writers at all. I prefer reasoned argument. What I think is really interesting is to ask, and I think Casper's beginning to raise this question, what was it about Western society that made this moment so appropriate for the new interest in atheism? Because really it hadn't been there, actually, in the recent past. So clearly something has happened. Mm. And my interesting question, which I'm sure we'll have a chance to explore during this conversation, is going to be, well, you know, where is this going to go in the future? Is it constantly dependent on religious developments to be able to make its case, or is there something intrinsic to it that actually gives it its relevance? Mm. I think that is very much up for debate. If we have time, I'd like to talk a bit about some of my concerns about the new atheism. Mm. I mean, I understand their ethical anger, but I do regret their overstatement. And at times, I have to say, I mean, they are very unfair to their opponents.
Well, we'll get into this in the course of the programme. If you're listening and you'd like to have your say as well, of course, as usual, you can respond to anything you hear on the programme today via the email address. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. What do you make of the new atheist movement as a whole? Are you an atheist? Do you describe yourself as a new atheist? Wherever you come from on the faith spectrum, it'd be interesting to hear from you. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you want to leave a phone comment and a voicemail message for me to play out on a future programme, that's 08456 52 52 52 and select option 8. Don't forget this programme available now as a podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Now, as well as obviously the one that many people know you for, Alistair, the Dawkins delusion, which, if you like, was aimed at quite a popular level, if you like, as a response to The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. You wrote a book recently as well called The Twilight of Atheism. That sounds like a ludicrous suggestion that atheism is in its twilight, given how much atheism seems to be in our headlines at the moment. There seems to be, if anything, a resurgence of atheism. So why did you title a book The Twilight of Atheism?
Looking at recent atheist writings then, this is some years ago, that we were seeing a certain degree of recycling. And what I was really puzzled by was, what is new here? And I was looking for some sort of indications as to where this might go. But I end the book by making a point which I think has proved to be almost prophetic. I say the future of atheism lies not so much with atheism as with religious people. If they do stupid things, I say, atheism will resurge. And that, I think, is exactly the point. One of the things that I'm sure Casper and I are going to talk about is whether new atheism is proactive or reactive. And I would certainly want to say there's a very strong reactive element. There's a very strong reaction to 9/11. Also, I would suggest to the George W. Bush presidency, Richard Dawkins gets very hot under the collar about that, and also to other developments like, for example, the continuing influence of religion in public life. So I do sense that the social context has generated this. But of course, my question then would be, what happens if the social context changes in the future? Are you dependent upon the social milieu for the appeal of the movement?
Mm. What do you make of the popularity of the new atheism?
Well, I just wanted to respond to one issue, which is the I think it's a little bit rich to accuse new atheism of recycling itself, because if anything, religion is the great recycler of itself because of the idea of, we've just had the Pope here, and he is in the process of recycling ideas which have got a very long history, and they call it tradition or revealed truth. You know, these things have not changed that much, and so in some sense it's understandable the response to them doesn't change that much either. It's a kind of reiteration that the argument doesn't really stand up. The difference is, of course, that The God Delusion was a humongous bestseller. Let's not pretend that it didn't sell millions and millions and millions of copies.
Well, it didn't sell millions and millions and millions.
Throughout the world,
it has. In the United States, for example, the sales figures were about 900,000. Whereas, for example, a book like, let's take a good example, let's take Rick Warren's book, The Purpose-Driven Life, sold 30 million the same sales.
Yeah, but he has a lot, Rick Warren has a lot of outlets. You see, Rick Warren has a big network of churches, he has radio stations, he has a huge public relations machine that sells it, right?
Richard Dawkins has a website which is promoting atheism on Richard Dawkins.
But exactly, and look how busy his website is. It's a very, very small operation. It's run by one person. I know he has a foundation now, but the point is, let's not pretend that there hasn't been a huge audience for what Richard Dawkins wanted to say, whether or not he was recycling arguments. In some sense, he was, but he was addressing them to the same arguments, some that you've made, arguments about the fine-tuning of the universe, about the blind, you know, the idea there must have been a creator. Some slightly more sophisticated arguments in the religious field, arguing for the existence of God using, for example, contemporary physics or new ideas about evolution or the idea there's a gap in the fossil record. But we have to account for the fact that there was a large appetite at the time. Now, perhaps it was to do with 9/11, but to do with the fact that people were anxious about, terrorism or the return of religion. And I think that it's probably important for me to say at this moment something which I've said before, and that I do think is true, is that I grew up in a world where there was what's called the secularization thesis, was the kind of the common sense of the day. You described it, Alistair, yourself. Modernity would eventually push out religious belief, and that was clearly happening all around. Church attendance was tanking. The religious voice was moving away from the public sphere, wasn't threatening me in any way as a secular person. I didn't feel I had to self-identify. And that has not happened. There are many, many interesting reasons why not, and we could talk about that for a long time. I'm not saying that people in the West are more religious. I think there's an argument that we can have about that, because I don't accept that. But in the world as a whole, the US is obviously a very specific case. In China, in many other parts of the world, in India, sub-Saharan Africa, in the West itself, because of immigration, you know, all kinds of interesting patterns have been going on. Religion has not disappeared and doesn't look likely that it will. So that's something that you know, non-religious people are facing up to, looking at. And new atheism is one articulation of that, I would argue, which is that people are feeling the need to stand up and argue back against arguments that they now see have some purchase in the world.
So is it... I don't know whether I'm not sure whether atheism is growing or stalling at this point, Alistair. I mean, what's your view? Are there more atheists about than there used to be now because of the influence of new atheism? Or is it just that the atheists that do exist are kind of coming off the fence and sort of speaking up more? You know, Richard Dawkins is encouraging the outing of atheists now, isn't he?
I think it's uncontroversial to say atheism is a much higher profile now than it had 10 years ago. I think that's fair. The numbers, I have not seen reliable figures. I just don't know. But certainly it is very much in the public sphere at the moment. My question really would be, you know, I'm kind of an old-fashioned liberal in many ways. I say live and let live. You know, I have no animus against atheists at all. I mean, you know, I have many who I get on with very, very well. What I'm puzzled by is why. I mean, Gary Wolfe, the guy who introduced the phrase new atheism, in the article in which he introduced it, said that for him, it seemed to him that the new atheism was not a sort of equal space for atheists. It was sort of a way much more, let's get religion out of public life. And what I would like to articulate simply is the idea that we've all got to live together in this very complex society in which we are, and just mutual respect is a very good way of doing this. And I have no problem with humanists. In fact, in one sense, I might be humanist myself, but in a different sense of the word, I think. For me, I think the real issue just is how on earth we're going to deal with differences in a society in which religion is very much a presence, could be a dangerous presence, but could equally be a positive presence. So I think it's really about negotiation of boundaries so we can all live together without indulging in violence.
You have made the point that the new atheism aims in some sense to bring back the Enlightenment, that it feels that we're wandering away from the ideas of rationality and reason, and that atheism, if you like, is the cure for that, that atheism has the answer. And if in that sense it is an evangelistic type of atheism that we're talking about, which says religion is actually a force for bad because it stops people being able to use their rational capability.
Well, I think that there is a very important point being made there, and I have no doubt there are some religious people who will simply say, well, you know, the Pope tells me to believe this, I believe that. They don't think. I'm not like that. I mean, reason converted me to Christianity in a very big way. So for me, the life of the mind is very important. It's certainly true, for example, that Chris Richards ends his very exciting and very interesting book, God is Not Great, with a sort of appeal, let's go back to the Enlightenment, which I think is a bit of romantic hankering after the good old days in a certain way. But certainly, I would not for one moment say that religion is anti-rational or irrational. I mean, I'm sufficiently aware of the debates to know that there are many rationalities, and therefore you can't simply say that is rational and everything else irrational. There are various possibilities for rationality, and we have to be careful about this. That's one of the reasons why postmodernity does have some traction in our culture. People can see that it's more complicated than perhaps some of these writers are suggesting.
I mean, this is the one of the criticisms levelled at the New Atheism, Casper, that it is in some sense historically naive, that it thinks we can, you know, if we just grab atheism and put it out there, that the world will be right again, that in the Enlightenment values will prosper.
I think that this might be the moment that we really make distinctions between what, you know, between the people that we're talking about. I mean, you know, we talked about the inadequacy of the term New Atheism, we talked about the idea of the Four Horsemen, we've talked about, I mean, most people, many more people have heard about Richard Dawkins and know a little bit about what he says, and they've read The God Delusion. Same for Christopher Hitchens. So let's just sketch it out a little bit. Daniel Dennett, who is a philosopher, psychology philosopher, professor, wrote a book called Breaking the Spell, in which he argued that religion was an important evolutionary development in human, or it developed because humankind wanted to find explanations for things which they were not able to generate themselves. So they created, as it were, a supernatural world, a world of supernatural explanations, perfectly rational, useful, and also social glue for society. And to make it very simple, he says we no longer need that because we have science to fill in those explanations. We know we can account for things in a different kind of a way. So religion has lost its evolutionary requirement. Okay, very polite, wasn't at all, shrill, wasn't anti-religion. So that was one of the arguments, and quite an important one, a very serious one, one that needs to be taken seriously. Not historically naive, because based on a really deep understanding of evolution and evolutionary processes. Maybe wrong, but not historically naive. Then you've got Sam Harris. In my view, he's my least favourite atheist author. I do think he's shrill. I think he's wrong. I think he's right wing. I disavow his basic arguments, and I'm not really interested in including him. And he's an American anyway, so we can leave him aside. Richard Dawkins has written some absolutely wonderful books about evolution. He's a brilliant science communicator. I think everyone would agree with that. In The God Delusion, I think there are lots of problems with it as a book. And I do think that if we focus in on Richard Dawkins, we could focus in on elements of historical or political naivety, or a slight sense that if only he could get everyone to read the book, they would go, oh, pack up, you know, close up the cathedral and go home. However, one of the things that Richard Dawkins does in The God Delusion is address some of the arguments, the kind of arguments that Alistair McGrath makes and many other people, where they make the argument in terms of reason, the argument for religion in terms of reason, or in terms of how the universe works and plausibility of explanation. And it's an absolutely brilliant, in my view, deconstruction and counter-argument to that. And it's not rude, and it's not shrill. Now, subsequently, Richard Dawkins has become a big media figure, okay? And so we can talk about how that's happened. Then there's Christopher Hitchens. He is a polemical journalist. He's not trying to start a movement. He's not trying to get people to follow him. He has written a book, which Alistair said is very exciting, and one of the things it is full of history. Now, it makes a very strong case, it may be an extremely loaded case, that religion has been involved in some absolutely terrible things and the source and cause of great many conflicts. And he has chapter and verse because he's been to these places. It's not naive in any way. It may be very polemical. It certainly is very polemical, and you may not agree with all of it. So it's a kind of piece of provocation, really.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it does.
Well, I think I find what you're saying very interesting. First of all, let me say how delighted I am that you said what you did about Sam Harris, because in my view, he is the most odious person out.
Me too. I mean, leave him aside. I'm ashamed of it.
I mean, he approves of torture. He says it's ethical that we can kill people we disagree with. I mean,
he's riding the American anti-Muslim different way. Exactly. And I just think we should leave
them to the side. Let's leave them out. Okay. I'm so pleased we can do that.
Just three horsemen.
Just
now.
Three. Okay. Three decent horsemen.
I think A.C. Grayling might have a case to be included as the
I think the three of we are on a higher plane altogether. Daniel Dennett is very interesting. He and I debated twice on this, once at the RSA here in London and then once over in the States. I mean, what he's saying is scientifically interesting, but the scientific evidence is terribly weak. It's all this might be, this could be. He rests very heavily on Richard Dawkins' idea of the meme, which is way out on the fringes of science. So I welcome the discussion he initiated. I think it was very, very interesting. But I think it's very much up in the air as to where it takes us.
But he's not shrill or militant or anti-religion in any way.
And in debate, he is very gracious. I fully concede that.
And he looks like Santa Claus.
Yes, he does. he does indeed. And then we have... Richard Dawkins, I'll come back to him because he's probably the best known. Christopher Hitchens is really interesting. But I read his book, and if I may say so, I think it's the best written of the Four Horsemen. It's beautifully written. He's a writer. The history is not good. I mean, let me give you two examples. He talks about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who, as all our readers will know, was martyred by the Nazis. Mm-hmm. I mean, in effect, he says he was a kind of humanist martyr, you know, and I find that astonishing. You know, Bonhoeffer was martyred for his faith. Or again, Martin Luther King, you know, who Chris Traitor says is a jolly good thing. I agree completely. But again, you know, he says there's no religion there. Well, I mean, the man was a Baptist pastor, and, you know, his...
I don't think that's a problem of history. That's a problem of interpretation. Well, I mean, I published an article by Richard Norman, who's a humanist philosopher, who says exactly the same thing. He says the problem with Chris Hitchens' book is he basically says anyone who was religious is wrong, and anyone who was right wasn't really religious.
Well, I know. That is the problem.
So that's a problem of politics, I would say. It's not that he doesn't know the history, it's that he's interpreted it to fit his thesis.
But it shows a mindset which, in effect, looks at history and then reads it in light of a predetermined mindset. So history doesn't make you think that way, it's that you think that way and you kind of shape history to suit it. Richard Dawkins, I think, is in my view, the best of these four horsemen and one most worth engaging with, partly because he's a scientist. And I used to be a scientist myself, so I do very much respect anybody who uses the sciences. It's just I find myself disagreeing with him at point after point that I think he raises all the right questions. The issue is I don't really think the answers he gives work very well.
We're going to just draw a brief halt to it there. We're already at the end of our first section, believe it or not. Wow. And I'd love to get some more on Richard Dawkins as we've arrived, as it were, at the zenith of the new atheism in his person. So we'll continue this conversation in just a short moment. I hope you're enjoying it as much as I am. We're looking at the new atheism today, asking, is it the future of atheism? Is it a bold new world? Or is there something rather old about the new atheism? Wonder what you think about today's topic. I'll be giving out the ways to get in touch in the next section of the programme again. Do hope you can continue listening to Unbelievable this afternoon.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome back to Unbelievable, the show that gets you thinking every Saturday afternoon with Christian and non-Christian debate. Before we go back into our programme on the new atheism, towards the end of today's programme, you'll want to keep tuned. I've got a special announcement about a certain somewhat controversial scientist who's coming to the UK in November, Michael Behe, one of the founders and leading proponents of the modern intelligent design movement. Hear what this show is doing with him when he comes to the UK in November towards the end of this programme. Right now, though, back into conversation with Alistair McGrath and Caspar Melville. We're looking at the new atheism. Richard Dawkins is its, if you like, founding father in some ways. They are looking at whether it is a bold new world here on the show that gets you thinking. Caspar, we've sort of had Alistair's views on some of the key figures here. The main point Alistair has been making is that they're not essentially doing anything new. They're more reacting. And is this the problem, that the new atheism will only survive as long as it's got something to react to in that sense?
Well, I mean, first of all, let's say that the people who we've identified as a new atheist do not self-identify as new atheists. They didn't self-consciously start a movement.
But didn't they? I mean, Richard Dawkins has started this sort of out campaign, this, you know, atheist alliance.
Well,
and all
yes,
this business.
He did. And whether that's got traction or not, I don't really know. I mean, you can buy a T-shirt off the internet that says, come out. I mean, I think that we need to look at that in relation to its different constituencies. You know, in England, it's not all Britain. It's not hard to be an atheist. It's not a big deal. It's not a question of coming out or wearing a big A T-shirt, although some people feel they want to do that, right? Or when the Pope comes, they want to shout about not believing in God and make a protest, fine. The Out campaign, I mean, we get letters at New Humanist from people who live in small towns in Brazil or small towns even in America who say, I cannot say that I'm an atheist. I'm in a place where it's completely expected that you're a Christian, or usually it is Christianity, although we know there are large parts of the world where it's Islam, where you can't say it. And for them, Richard Dawkins is a very important figure. You can go on the internet, you can find someone who says it's absolutely okay to self-identify like this, come and join us. And I think that is still, on a global scale, an important message to send. I mean, we know that it's, in certain countries, you know, you can really get killed for saying that you don't believe in God. And that situation, I believe, is wrong. Richard Dawkins obviously believes is wrong. And that keeps a kind of momentum going to that strand of, if you want to call it new atheism, he doesn't say that on the website, but that is an atheist out campaign. Now, I'm not particularly interested in that because I don't have a problem being an atheist, and lots of my readers don't. So I'm more interested in the intellectual content. And in terms of the intellectual content, yes, of course, new atheism is reactive. It has reacted. It's there to answer back to the way that religion has re-entered our public culture. And it's done a very good job of that, although it's a limited job because, in the one hand, it's got some problems with it that we've talked about already. You know, none of those books are perfect, none of the arguments are perfect, but they've created lots of really nice ripples and really nice responses, which have been great as a magazine editor because I've published loads of them. You know, we've interviewed Terry Eagleton, who's got very funny things to say about Richard Dawkins. Dawkins has got funny answers to that. People responding to Christopher Hitchens. It's a great intellectual whirl, which actually is fascinating for all of us. But the question now, I mean, I produced an event at the RSA, which is called After New Atheism, Where Next for the God Debate? And what we did was bring together Marilyn Robinson, who's a novelist and a believer
and
in God,
yeah.
And Roger Scruton, who says he's an Anglican, although you know, he's a kind of rationalist as well, but he's a conservative. Jonathan Ray, who is a humanist and a non-believer and a sort of left-wing person, with Laurie Taylor, who's the chairman of the charity that I run, the Rationalist Association. And that we're just going to say, well, where can we take this debate in a positive direction? It's actually, as I said in a piece I wrote about this, is that I think we're all getting a bit bored with the new atheist debate, in all honesty. I think it's said what it needs to say. Some people are going to continue wanting to be very militant and answer back. We've still got some very serious issues. We've got bishops in the House of Lords, in my view, which is, you know, anti-democratic and I think doesn't suit our country at all. And in fact, if you look at the religious makeup of our country, Anglicanism is not the growing religion. There are many other kinds of religion. Secularism protects minority religious interests, and that's the system I think we should really push forward on. We've got creationism. We've got issues about faith schools, which I still think are very important political issues. There's obviously religious violence and terrorism and things like that. These are all very big questions. There's human rights issues. There's how can we create a better and fairer world. All that is a humanist concern par excellence. It's not exactly about God not existing.
No, exactly. And all of these things you've just mentioned wouldn't necessarily just be atheist concerns. They are
precisely. And that's why we want to bring together a constituency of people. We might have big arguments about that, but we might also be able to find a way forward, a new set of heroes. If it's not the Enlightenment, who might it be that can help us to move? I mean, it will partly be the Enlightenment, but it might also be people like William James, who had a much more interesting take on religion than new atheism has in many ways.
What's your response there, Alistair? Because it doesn't sound like Casper's suggesting that religion, Christianity per se, has to move out of the debate and make way for atheism as its natural successor. He's saying we've got to, you know, live in a society where we, you know, come to understand these things.
Well, this is the sane voice of atheism. I mean, I would want to say that this is someone one can talk to. I think that there is a problem about the tone of the new atheism. I mean, that is. I mean, religious believers just find it offensive. And because they find it offensive, they just don't take it seriously. So, in effect, you know, there is a serious problem about, for example, Hitchens' caricatures of things just mean people don't take them seriously. So there is a real issue there. I think that, going back to the point you were raising at the beginning, though, is the new atheism reactive? Julian Baggini is a very interesting atheist writer. The Short Guide to Atheism, I think, is quite well done. And he wrote a very interesting article for the Norwegian magazine Free Thought, in which he said that for him there were two big problems in new atheism. One, he says, is that it's reactive. Without a bishop to bash, you know, what is it? And he wasn't saying that was true of atheism. He was saying it was true of the new atheism. I think that is very important because we must make a distinction between atheism in general and this particular kind of atheism, which I think actually has done atheism a disservice. Every time I talk to my atheist friends about the new atheism, they say that they will say that certain people who I'm not going to mention because this might be defamatory are an embarrassment for atheism.
Well, perhaps most famously Michael Ruse, who is happy to be quoted on the front cover of your book.
These are just ordinary people, ordinary atheists who are saying, look, you know, we are humiliated by the antics of, and they mention some certain names, which we might have already mentioned on this programme. But I'm moving on, because Pagini's second point is really very interesting. He says that the big problem with new atheism is it says we are rational and everyone else is not. You know, and that is, for him, the big problem, because he's a philosopher and he says, look, it's obvious that there is a kind of rationality in religious belief. We've got to be honest about that. I say that that's a kind of... I can debate with that kind of person. I mean, Casper is right. There are many issues that we need to debate. I mean, I personally am not sure secularism protects religion. I think secularism, in effect, is proposing itself as a kind of honest referee. But actually, I mean, I think you do have your own agendas. And I think it's very important to kind of lay those on the table as well. But if we were to say, in terms of we've got to find some way of having equal space for everybody, well, I'm up for that. I mean, I'm not an imperialist. I just want to be able to get on with what I'm doing, really.
So
I mean,
you would back a disestablishment of the Church of England?
I don't really think the establishment of the Church of England is such a good idea. I don't think we should have a House of Lords. I mean, I'm surprised you are so reactive that you're simply saying abolish bishops. I mean, the real problem is the House of Lords itself. I mean, that seems to me to be another programme.
Part of the reform,
well,
surely.
No. I believe in a real reform, not a half-hearted reform.
But would you not identify yourself as a secular person? I mean, you said you as if secular system would be secularist. But actually, secular, the word is misused all the time. Surely secular is someone who accepts that no one religious belief will have the upper hand in any system.
In its original sense, secular meant someone who lived in the world. And for me, you know, the American Constitution does seem to, in effect, create space for everybody. And that does seem to me to be a kind of model I wish we could have here in Britain. I mean, I was saying earlier, I mean, I would self-define as a humanist, but a humanist in the sense of Erasmus of Rotterdam or some of the greats of the 14th, 15th centuries, where there's this very real emphasis on the importance of the fulfillment of human nature. You know, we need to become what we're meant to be. And for most of them, that was linked with God. For you, it will not be. But certainly, this idea of really longing to fulfill human potential is very important for everyone, even though there is a big debate about what is necessary to actually fulfill human potential. And in that sense, if in a very limited sense, I would describe myself as a humanist myself. But for me, humanity really comes into its own. It is excited, it's enriched when you discover God. I know you won't share that viewpoint, but there are an awful people who would share what I'm saying, and somehow we've got to find out a way of, you know, jostling alongside on this one.
Can I ask you, I mean, it's very interesting that you've presented your religious belief as a matter of reason and rationality, and I agree with you, and Jonathan Ray says this in New Humanist many times, and I have been persuaded by the argument, which is you can't just turn around and say that people you disagree with are irrational and that you're rational. That's stupid. And of course, religious belief is rational in so many ways. You know, the tests suggest that, you know, it's better for you and it makes you more, a nicer person. Always. I mean, that you can argue that, but it's not. I don't believe it's irrational. However, there are certain elements of religious belief, and this is where, since you have a religious belief and base it on rationality, which I find very, very hard to understand. And one of them is the idea that reason has led you to believe that one particular religious story is the one that's true, and I suppose by definition then that the other ones aren't true. I mean, you're a Christian, you're not a Hindu, you're not Jewish, and you're not a Scientologist, and you're not a Jedi.
If I can add in on this... One particular philosopher who has already been mentioned here was asked, I asked him if he would like to contribute to this debate, and he said, well, first of all, ask Alistair McGrath why he believes in his God instead of all the Norse gods and all the Greek gods, and
well, that's really
and
impressive.
Why fairies at the bottom of the garden aren't a good enough
talking
explanation.
To AC Grayley?
Yes, you guessed it.
He's very good at predictable soundbites, and I admire that enormously.
but I mean, essentially,
but
what,
that really
what,
is that
what,
is
what
the point
asking,
at which
yes,
I'm saying, questioning well, the reason behind
well,
your religious belief.
And then, in turn, I will ask you a question.
Yep.
Because I mean, you've rightly made the point that we all define our lives by stories. I think that is one of the big changes in philosophy in the last 100 years: the realization stories really change everything. And for me, the Christian Christian story is compelling. It's compelling for a number of reasons. One is because I believe to be well-grounded in history and reason. But also, I think this is the key thing, it places all other stories without disrespecting them. For me, Christianity brings to fulfillment, for example, the aspirations I see in the Norse legends. That's one of the points that C.S. Lewis, who, as you probably know, was deeply in love with the Norse legends, made very, very clearly. So the question is, why do I believe this to be right? Well, it's almost empirically. As a scientist, I ask, what is the best fit? You know, which way of looking at things is the best way of making sense of things? It's almost like Peter Lipton's very good book, Inference to the Best Explanation, where you're looking at a whole series of things saying, what is the best way of making sense of this? And having taken the opportunity to compare and contrast, for example, secular, Islamic, Jewish, and Christian ways of looking at things, I came to the conclusion that Christianity is the one that works. So for me, that is the answer. You would, I imagine, take a secularist reading of things, which actually in its own way is telling a story too. And obviously I'd be very interested to know what made you think that that was the best way of making sense of
things. Well, very many stories with a lot of doubt involved. But does that mean, for example, that I'm just interested in this. I'm not trying to provoke you. Well, maybe I am. But let's go back just before, historically, before Jesus was born. Does that mean that, you know, before then, the story, you know, was different, or those people were wrong? Or, you know, I mean, you know, the Vikings or the Anglo-Saxons or the tribes that, I mean, they didn't know God, really, because Jesus hadn't come and hadn't been
born and
hadn't
died. I would argue that really what we are dealing with, this is a sort of line that John Paul II took in his very interesting letter, Faith and Reason, which is, I think, a very good statement of this position. He simply said, look, people are always questing for truth. They're doing it with honesty and with integrity. And we're all looking for the best way of making sense of things. And the point I would want to make, echoing that, is that I respect with complete integrity human attempts to try and find the truth. In all humility, I think I have found an answer which I believe to be right, just as I know you've found an answer which you believe to be right. And therefore, the question really is, how does my way of looking at things help make sense of what other people are doing? Because clearly I cannot say, in a sort of rather arrogant way, these people are deluded and wrong. That's the sort of view I associate with a new atheism. But I think I hear you distancing yourself from that, and I'm very pleased about that. But it seems to me that really we've got to find a way of, in effect, saying, look, genuinely, others are looking for truth, and that quest is to be honoured. It's not to delude.
But it seems to me, I mean, not to be rude, but it seems, actually, I'm not like you in that. I don't think I've found an answer that I deem to be right. I mean, to me, it's a perpetual quest. You talked about the quest for truth. The quest is it, right? Life is the quest. Life is looking at all the stories, trying to glean from stories some meaning, trying to be the best person you can be in the world. I don't think I've found the truth. And I really worry about people who claim that they have found the truth, because the next thing that they want to do is tell other people about that truth, and then the next thing is they want to impose that version of reality on other people. And that is the kind of imperial element of religion, which I find really, really difficult to deal with. And so I choose doubt over certainty, fundamentally. The new atheist, to me, the lesson there is the arguments don't stack up. There is, you know, it's implausible. The existence of God is implausible. And therefore, I have rejected that as an alternative. And therefore, I have to try and construct my own version of very sort of provisional truth all the time, still looking. That's why I still want to read books, you know. To me, I don't have one good book that I live my life by. I have thousands of books, and I'm still looking for new ones, and I learn a new thing from a new book.
Are you suggesting that religion effectively ends the quest for openness?
Sometimes it does, and I think that's self-evident, because we know societies where people only read one book, they only have access to one book, there's one set of stories. I mean, you know, I don't want to pick out one particular religion, but one of the things I do sometimes is talk. I go to an Islamic school and I talk to some Malaysian civil servants who come over to the UK, and they're looking around and learning about the UK and secularism. And I say to them, they're fascinated that I don't believe in God, and they ask me about that. And then I talk to them about why they do, and they just treat it as a self-evident truth. And then when I ask them about, well, how do you do this or how do you do that, they say, oh, well, you know, the Quran tells you how to do it. It's got a way. It's like a how-to book on how to live your life. Now, you can see that it's very effective for certain things, community cohesion, you know, a certain security and a sense of they really felt that they discovered the truth. On the other hand, to me, that was a nightmare kind of scenario, a nightmare world. When I said to them, would you bring your children up within Islam? And they said, absolutely. And I said, well, what if they wanted to do something else? And they said, no, but Islam's right. Islam's the best way to do it. So there was no sense that you could question. And we all know that there have been schools run by religious groups who, if you try and pose questions, awkward questions to ideas articulate in the Bible, you know, might get your knuckles wrapped or worse. So this is the element of Christianity or any religious belief I find very, very worrying and hard to deal
with. Casper, you made some good points there, but the new atheism is just as bad. I mean, they are. Listen, this
the
is.
The new atheism do not wrap anyone's knuckles. There's no violence, there's no schools, there's no. They're not telling you how to think.
This is Christopher Hitchens on Mother Teresa. He said in a TV interview, "She is a fanatic and a fundamentalist and a fraud, and millions of people are much worse off because of her life, and it's a shame there's no hell for your bitch to go to." I mean, that's just rude.
But he's not the headmaster of a school. He's not
equivalent of an atheist pope. He is highly influential.
Oh, come
this
on,
Alice.
An atheist pope. The pope is telling people. There are people in the world who have children who don't want those children because the pope tells them that they mustn't use contraception. Christopher Hitchens does not have that kind of power. He may be fated by all intellectuals or journalists who are jealous of his journalistic career, but actually he doesn't have any power.
The point
apart
is
apart from
that
the power of his pen and the power to be polemical.
Yes, but he's being polemical and actually rather rude, and that is one of the recent points I like. No, I can't continue. Do you mind if I just continue? Because I think I would like to get my point in. Of course religion can be abusive, but I want to make the point that one of the things that new atheism needs to face up to is that it's doing the same thing. It's morphing into a religion, and that should worry many atheists in this country, because it means atheism is being judged by these people who I think are bringing it into disrepute. Now, you were kind enough to suggest that I've kind of got into some kind of intellectual rut. I think what you need to bear in mind is that sometimes, you know, when you're journeying and questing, as I was, you actually come to a place and think, hey, I think this is right. And, you know, I'd like to ask you, do you think you're ever going to come to a place in which you will pause in your questing and say, you know, hey, I think this might be right, this is where I'm going to stop? Or by definition, are you going to keep questing? Because it seems to me there's a very interesting difference between us here. I think I've found the truth. I'm very happy to tell people why is. I'm not imposing on anybody, but nevertheless, you seem to be saying that thinking you found the truth seems to be almost a bad thing in itself, and I'd love to know what you think about that.
Yeah, I do think that. I mean, I'm worried about people who stand up and say, I found the truth. I mean, if you're saying, it's my truth, you know, this is what I believe, this is my truth, that's fine. But actually, if scratching the surface a bit, you're not just going to say that, I presume. You're going to say, I found the truth for me, for everyone else, and actually it's the truth of the world, it's the truth of human nature.
But isn't that what Richard Dawkins says?
He's doing that in the Godelution.
In what way does he say that?
He's saying this is what's right.
No, yeah. All he says is, that argument is wrong. He doesn't say... He doesn't say, I know the truth of human nature, I know what consciousness is. He implies that science might be able to find those answers, and I disagree with him about that, because I think science... I don't think something like the truth of human nature, the truth of why we're here, is amenable to one single answer. The point is to continue to ask the question, and doubt about it is absolutely built in, because actually that doubt is a kind of, in my view anyway, religion has done a good job of giving answer to this question, because the real question, it seems to me, is why am I going to die? You know, why was I born if I'm going to die? Now, religion has spent a lot of time explaining and talking to people about that and trying to comfort them about that. Now, I live without that comfort. So I have to find other comfort. And my other comfort is, here I am. I am a human being. I've got some life to live. And isn't it fascinating to try and figure out, for example, what human nature is? Is there any purpose? And I can look up in the stars, like Richard Dawkins encourages you to do, and go, well, why would I think there's a purpose for me personally? Because look how enormous the universe is. And then also I can have a nice dinner with my family and I can feel and think, wow, this moment, you know, might be what it's all about. But none of it is capital T truth that I can go around or try and conscript other people into believing. I accept their right to make their own journey on that. And actually, if I ever felt that I've come to that moment where I've reached the final truth or final revelation, that would really worry me, because, you know, what keeps me going is intellectual curiosity and wanting to answer a question that I'm not sure is possible to answer.
I mean, I don't know whether, in a sense... I'm confused here, because in some sense Richard Dawkins is very against this idea of there being truths, one truth for me, another truth for you. He says there is a truth, either, you know, there is a God or there is not a God. You know, we can't have it both ways. Either science is true, the claims it makes, or religion's claims are true, and he sees them as incompatible, and therefore one must be the winner.
Yes.
And so in that sense, he is making definite truth claims, isn't he? He is saying, he's very averse to any kind of postmodern
That's right. He's making truth claims. Well, it's not relativistic, but the implication is, because if you look at what he says about science, he implies that science might be able to reveal all the truths that are there to be revealed, but actually he'll say that actually science has only got a certain way down the path, but it's the best way
but
to find
But he also believes it's
things.
The only way.
He does believe it's the only way. Now, I personally don't agree with that. I'm not a scientistic type of person. I mean, I think we talked about stories, narrative, drama, art. You know, I think these are also ways to access kinds of truths about human life, which science has got nothing to do with. You know, I don't think science can tell me anything about love
or
mourning.
Are you a materialist atheist then, or are you edging towards something a little bit more?
I'm not a materialist.
Supernatural, transcendent.
Not supernatural. Transcendent. I mean, I noticed that you wanted to talk about that as your big question, and it depends what you mean by transcendent. I mean,
what do you mean by transcendent, Alistair?
Well, people mean different things by it, but for me, transcendent means there is something beyond us, which, when discovered, fulfills us, and the quest for it is a good thing. And that seems to me to be a very deep instinct in human nature, and certainly it's one which I know in myself. And again, although I hear Casper's points about this, you know, in all humility, I believe I found this, or at least I found the best way of getting hold of this. And I think the real issue is, I think we are seeking creatures. I think that's right. But sometimes when you seek, you do find. And our debate, really, I think, is whether we perennially quest and never find and thus remain unsatisfied, or whether actually some people do say, actually, this seems to be right, it's jolly good, I'm going to stay here, which is what I personally
have
ended
up
doing.
But what's our human experience of satisfaction? I mean, I'm a Freudian when it comes to this sort of thing. Satisfaction is always temporary. You know, humans have a lack. They have a sense, the quest is driven by something. The quest is driven for desire to acquire, by desire, but to acquire something, whether it's sexual satisfaction or food or beyond that, you know, intellectual satisfaction. These things are always temporary, in my view. And the idea that someone is permanently satisfied, to me, that sounds to me not only a smug person, but also a potential dictator. Look at me, I'm satisfied. All I'm going to do now is tell you about how satisfied I am. That's, to me, like a nightmare. And I don't think that's really what human nature is about. The quest, which I think only ends with death, I don't believe it ends with the discovery of a big capital T truth. However, your description of your quest, I thought, the thing that comes closest to that is science, in my view. I'm sure I feel that there's something larger than myself. Well, science, and I've discovered it, and it helped make meaning out of my own life. I mean, watching, Brian Cox do The Wonders of the Solar System, you know there's something larger than yourself. There's something very profound about the idea of how absolutely enormous the universe is. There are 100 billion galaxies in our universe. I mean, just try and think about what that means. There's definitely something larger than yourself. It puts you in context, and it then takes you back to yourself and goes, well, I'm totally insignificant in one sense. In another sense, here I am. I'm a consciousness in a human body, here for a certain amount of time. I better make the most of it. And to me, that is a classic humanist view of things.
Why for you is that not the most appealing story of our significance?
I mean, for me, science is a very good story. It is a way of looking at things as a journey, which you're trying to discover things. And what Casper has articulated is actually a very good account of what science is doing. But it's only part of the picture. And for me, what happens if you're able to discover something which actually makes sense of the capacity of science to make sense? And for me, belief in God actually is this rather wonderful discovery that if there were a God like this, like the Christian tradition suggests, it actually makes an awful lot of sense of things. And again, going back to your sense of looking at the universe in a sense of awe and wonder and being overwhelmed by it, I mean, I know that, I identify that, but I would see it very much in light of the Psalms, Psalm 8, you know, when I consider the heavens, the work of fingers, what is man? He's so small, but you love him nonetheless. And so for me, it's a very important supplementation of scientific narrative, not a contradiction of it, but actually just saying there's an added level which, if brought into play, really changes everything.
We are going to have to take another quick break, I'm afraid, gentlemen, and we'll just have time for some summing up of our thoughts in what's been a fascinating discussion today. Really enjoyed the interaction thus far. Alistair McGrath and Casper Melville, my guests on Unbelievable today. Alistair McGrath, Professor of Theology at King's College London. He's an author. And we've been looking at the new atheism today with Casper, who is editor of New Humanist magazine and CEO of the Rationalist Association. I'm putting links up to both my guests where you can find out more info on them and the books and the magazines they represent. So check that out at premier.org.uk/unbelievable and join us again in a few minutes' time for the conclusion of today's programme.
Welcome back to Unbelievable, the third part of the programme here. So we're going to hear our final contributions from our guest today. But as I said earlier, you'll want to keep listening towards the end of the programme. We'll not only hear your feedback in 10 minutes or so, but I'll also be giving you details of a very interesting event that we're going to be running in conjunction with Michael Behe in November the 22nd, Monday the 22nd of November. And details are on the website right now at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And with this podcast, very controversial character, someone that I'm sure both my guests today would disagree with. He is, though, one of the key proponents of the intelligent design movement. Find out what we're doing and how you can come along and hear what he has to say towards the end of this programme. But right now, back into the final part of a discussion on the new atheism. Is it a bold new world? Alistair McGrath and Caspar Melville, my guests today.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, gentlemen, a lot has been said, and I get the feeling, Caspar, you're not, in a sense, a new atheist. You see the problems there. I think, in some sense, you, in a way, though, are not displeased with the fact that atheism is very much in the limelight because of characters like Dawkins, and you're hardly going to turn him away if he wants to submit an article to your magazine, are you? I mean, in a sense, as much as you see that there are, you know, some problems and, you know, extremes out there. For you, presumably, the new atheism is welcome in terms of at least the debate it's generated.
Absolutely. I mean, I would say, you know, I've got to be honest, new atheism has been good for business. Richard Dawkins was kind enough to put our magazine at the back of God Delusion. He's driven a lot of people to our site. We had him recently on the Pope, and the quote was widely, you know, went around the world and was widely sort of publicised and brought. And I welcome him in the argument. And I've never identified myself as a new atheist. I am an atheist. I think, you know, if I have to come down on one side or the other, I'm not a new atheist in the sense that, you know, atheism is a fairly straightforward suggestion that you don't think God exists. And that was the same when atheism first started. And in many ways, if you ask the so-called new atheists, they'll admit that there's nothing
much new
about it.
And you disavow this idea that there is a faith element to atheism.
Completely. And I think, you know, I mean, I would like to debate more about why Alistair thinks that new atheism is a religion of any kind. I mean, religions tend to set up in this, you know, they have storefronts, they have preachers, they have gospels, they have things.
Well, I'm thinking of the God Delusion, Richard Dawkins, as you mentioned these things.
But, you know,
these are perhaps the things
one man.
That
and actually, as Alistair has noted, and it's exactly the same thing for me and my audience, many, many people don't agree with him. But it's great that they don't agree with him, and it's thrown up so many interesting arguments. And, you know, and he may feel that he wants to start a movement. I mean, he has made gestures towards that. I don't think a movement like that would get off the ground in Britain, maybe in America, I don't know. And I'm not particularly interested. I'm not a movement kind of person, and many free thinkers, which I really consider myself.
But you do see, in some sense, the extreme of suggesting that theology should be thrown out the window, that there's no place for
it
in our universities, these sort of things you feel is overstated.
This is why I think we need to move to a new phase. And the new, I mean, there are two quotes which I treasure, both of them from New Humanist. Richard Dawkins said to Laurie Taylor in an interview, "Some people say that I'm wrong to dismiss theology, but actually, why should I, you know, I don't believe in fairies at the bottom of the garden, so why should I read fairyology? I don't need fairyology to tell me there's no fairies." On the other hand, Terry Eagleton, who's a big critic of Dawkins, in another interview said to Laurie Taylor, reading Richard Dawkins on theology is a bit like reading someone on biology who has only ever read the British Book of Birds. And actually, I think Eagleton's right about this. I think my conception of religion is that, irrespective of whether God exists, which I don't believe he does, is religions are amazing human inventions. They are themselves stories, art, culture, society. It's an amazing storehouse, and theology itself is an amazing storehouse of right and wrong answers to questions about why are we here, you know, what should we do, and all, you know. So I'm fascinated with all kinds of, there's been hundreds, there have been thousands of religions in human history, and they're all, to me, very, very fascinating and worthwhile.
But they can all
at.
Be, in a sense, explained. They can be reduced. There is no actual transcendent that these are in some way reaching towards. I mean, you do make
towards.
A truth claim there about them all.
I think
say
they're reaching towards, but
they're
not
all
getting
wrong.
There. No, I don't think they're wrong. I mean, that would just be stupid in saying they're wrong. It's like going to an opera and watching it and then getting to it and saying, well, that was wrong. I mean, that's just not the right way to think about it. In my view, they're fascinating, like they're artefacts. You know, theology is an artefact, religion is an artefact, all the wonderful gods. My son, you know, is absolutely obsessed with all the different gods. Hindus have 800,000 gods. I mean, how fascinating. One of them lives in the anus, apparently. But so these things are a resource, and I do think that religion has been a place for economic reasons as much as anything else, where wonderful things have happened as well as terrible things, and we can't just and shouldn't just sweep it all away. We should try, and I'm not sure how this is going to work, but I'm going to try opening up that conversation on the basis that in the end, no, the problem is that when you're talking to someone with religious belief, at a certain point they have to say, well, I'm right about this, and that's the point at which we're going to have to disagree.
It's been great having you on the programme, Casper. Perhaps a final thought and response yourself, Alistair.
Oh, well, I've very much enjoyed talking to Casper. I just wish we had more time because we've skimmed the surface of some very interesting discussions. I think, on balance, I welcome the arrival of the new atheism. It has turbocharged discussion about God, and I think that's only a good thing. It kind of got into the doldrums a bit, and I think in many ways it's been spiced up. And I think some of it actually isn't very good, and we're not talking about Sam Harris, but for me that is a good example of how not to get engaged. I much prefer Dawkins and Hitchens, who I think overstate hopelessly, but nevertheless they give you the opportunity of engaging with it. And certainly if you read Richard Dawkins' websites, they describe people like me who want to argue with Richard Dawkins as being fleas for daring to want to argue with them. But I take the view, hey, you know, you start a discussion, you welcome those who join in. And I think there's some very important points to talk about here. Where is the new atheism going? I personally hope that the sooner we stop talking about new atheism, the better. I don't think it shows new atheism in a good light, the atheism in a good light. And I think also it really has polarized discussion. I wish to go back to older days with people like Iris Murdoch, who are atheists that Christians take very, very seriously and want to dialogue with her because she so clearly offers you lots of possibilities for thinking about things and so on. Richard Dawkins dismisses theology, but for me, theology is a critical study of what Christians believe and why. I do wish he would study it sometime, because it might actually lead to a more informed debate. But the thing I think I simply want to say is that for me, the question of where the new atheism goes is a real question, because it's not entirely clear to me. And I personally think that, you know, in many ways there are ideas here which have been around for a very long time that were given, I said, but new credibility by events that happened. Mm. What I want to know is, supposing events don't happen, how do these ideas have legs? What goes on from here? And I think this debate's very interesting. There's no doubt that religion is back in a big way. People want to talk about God. I think that's great. I think it's going to be very interesting where these conversations go in future, because I think they're really very interesting.
Well, I hope you gentlemen will both join me again at some point down the line for more conversations in this area as events unfold. But thanks for being with me on the programme today. Don't forget, you can find out more about my guests. You can find out how to get hold of New Humanist magazine, which Casper is the editor of. You can also find out more about Alistair's writings and what he does as a job. You can find it all at the website of this programme. That's Unbelievable. So go to premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And we're going to be hearing some of your comments on past programmes in just a moment's time, and I'll be reminding you how you can get in contact with the programme yourself.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thanks again to my guests. And something I just forgot to do at the top of the hour there was tell you what's coming up on next week's programme. You may remember that the week before this, Alistair was with us talking about Hawking's universe and whether God is a redundant entity when it comes to the Big Bang and that kind of thing. Fascinating conversation he had with Roger Penrose last week, and I've got some of your feedback coming up on it. But next week, because we didn't get time to answer many of the questions or look at even at many of the questions that came in on the Premier community, we're devoting a special show to it again next week. I'm going to have John Polkinghorne joining me, also Hugh Ross lined up as well. He's an American physicist from Reasons to Believe. And atheist Nikolai Segura, who's an atheist scientist. So we should have some interesting responses to the many questions that came my way in the wake of Stephen Hawking's statements about the universe. That's coming up at the same time next week. If you want to get in touch with the show about what you heard today about the new atheism, I'd love to get your emails. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Again, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you're in the mood for discussing it with others, why not log on to the Unbelievable group of the Premier community? That's at our homepage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And that's where, of course, you can find today's programme and many more besides it. And I'll be linking through to information on today's guests and other programmes that are relevant. Okay, I've been promising before I got to the feedback to tell you about this event that we're hosting with Michael Behe. Now, when I heard Michael Behe was coming to the UK, I thought too good an opportunity to pass up doing something with him while he's here. He is, of course, a very controversial character in a very controversial area of science, intelligent design. It was his book, The Darwin's Black Box, which 10 years ago really launched the modern intelligent design movement, continues to be a seminal work, if you like. And he really was the person who coined the phrase irreducible complexity, his thesis being that the complexity of the tiny machines in the cell show that there must be a design to biology in these very complex machines that cannot have come about by a gradualistic Darwinian evolutionary process. Is he onto something, or is he simply a maverick at odds with real science? Those are the kinds of things we'll be asking as we host an evening with Michael Behe. Darwin or design is what we're asking. And this is on Monday, the 22nd of November, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m. Doors are at 6:30 at Westminster Chapel. OK, and that's in central London, Buckingham Gate in London, SW1. Cost is just £10. We're trying to keep this as minimal as possible just to cover our costs. And you can find out more and book tickets at the website. There's a link from the show page at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. If you can navigate your way to the information that comes with this podcast, I'll put it there as well. Do check out premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And click through if you'd like to book yourself in for that. There'll be lots of time after Michael's presentation for question and answer. We expect a very robust question and answer session, because obviously this is not an issue that is a Christian issue per se. You know, there are plenty of Christian scientists who really disagree with intelligent design. So it'll be interesting to hear as many of those points of views put to Michael during the course of that evening. Again, it's Monday, the 22nd of November. From 6:30 p.m. for a 7 p.m. start at Westminster Chapel. Cost is £10, and I'll be hosting the event. I do hope to see you there. Next week on the show, at this time during the sort of feedback section, I will have a brief conversation with Michael Behe on the line from America, and he'll tell us why he's coming over, what the purpose of this particular event is, and more besides. So, again, if you want to find out more, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And just to whet the appetite even more, every person who books for this, and I should say that registration in advance online is essential for this event, because it won't necessarily be possible to get in on the night. Everyone who registers in advance at our website gets a free copy of the DVD Unlocking the Mystery of Life. Okay, so if that hasn't perked your interest, I don't know what will. So do go again, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, to find out more about Darwin or Design, an evening with Michael Behe, coming up in November. You'll hear more about that in future programmes as well. OK, let's get to some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. Now, last week, as I say, Alistair McGrath joined us with Roger Penrose. Quite a few blogs have picked up on that programme. There's a little video as well of some interchanges, especially what Penrose said about Hawking's M-theory, which is on YouTube. And if you just search Penrose Christian Radio, you'll find that quite a few people have been looking at that. Here's though what Michael Allen wanted to say. I believe, Michael, you're a physicist yourself. You say, what a wonderful discussion between Sir Roger Penrose and Alistair McGrath. I think Sir Roger, while never betraying his atheist beliefs, reclaimed science as a search into things unknown, and was willing to explore another approach to science, more open and very different from the dogmatic approach of Dawkins and Hawking. As a scientist myself, I was so pleased to hear a more open approach to science than we're getting from some of today's shrill and dogmatic apologists for science. Well done, Justin, Sir Roger and Alistair. Thank you very much for those thoughts. I think you've also posted your comments up at the Unbelievable page, the Unbelievable group of the Premier community. So if you want to interact with the thread that's going on there about it, again, that's premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and click through to that particular to the Premier community, and you can get involved in talking about things. Mauricio Lopez says, hello, gents. Interesting conversation. However, my views are that these theories won't be able to be proven and will always be a creation of one's mind. And of course, one of the big things that came up in that program was Roger Penrose's own view of the universe, a very novel view of this idea of eons of time, where there is a Big Bang and then an eon later another Big Bang, sort of continuously. So you say, I send a challenge to the scientists. You wanted to quote Jeremiah 31 and 36. Thus saith the Lord, if heaven above can be measured and the foundations of the earth searched out beneath, I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith the Lord. God is saying here that if you're able to find the reasons and the boundaries of the universe and prove your theories about the universe, then Israel won't exist. We won't exist at all. What do you think, says Mauricio? Well, I mean, obviously, that verse does appear to read as though God's saying, you know, this is such a big thing that you will never fully understand it. And I don't know, I think probably many Christian scientists would acknowledge that sort of sentiment. But I don't know whether our atheist colleagues would say that's defeatist in some way. If you've got a response to that, whether that sort of has anything to say to this conversation, that verse from Jeremiah, if heaven above can be measured and the foundations of the earth searched out beneath, then I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith the Lord. Be interested to hear from you. Going back to previous programmes, we did two programmes, obviously, on the Catholic Church in the wake of the Pope's visit to the UK. The last one we did was on whether the papacy is biblical, and a number of you have been continuing to email in on that. William Johnstone was the Catholic, formerly a Protestant, who converted to Catholicism. He was in debate with Duncan Boyd of the Protestant Truth Society. Here's what Douglas Cumming in Gibraltar says. Just heard the programme, as stimulating as ever. A quick response to the comment made several times by William Johnstone that the Catholic Church can't have gone too far off the tracks because Jesus promised that the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And you say, the gates of hell indeed did not prevail against the Church. God sent Martin Luther and the Reformers to set it on the right track again. It just was not the same institution that William Johnstone was thinking about. Thanks for a great programme. This from Nick says, hi, Justin. My wife and I were listening to the programme, and I got to discuss a number of points with her. I actually thought William's performance gave me numerous reasons not to be a Catholic. First off, he appealed to an authority. Well, I'd just as well ask, why choose the authority you did? After all, he says they teach Jesus as saviour and how to live a happy life. Well and good. So do the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses. They also have great unity within their belief systems. Why not join one of them, if that's the standard? Secondly, you say of William the Catholic on the show, he claims that we need a pope to interpret scripture, but he'll point to Matthew 16 and John 21 as if we should clearly see the pope in these passages. Why? Because we ought to understand that they mean, that is, understand what they mean outside of the pope, while still saying we need the pope to understand what they mean. Not only that, what kind of reasoning is it to say we need a pope, as the Bible teaches, so we can have someone to interpret scripture for us? Well, how do you know the Bible teaches that? Look here at Matthew 16. Well, how do you know your interpretation of that is correct? Because the pope says so. It is ultimately circular. So you wanted to bring up those points as well as some others. I pray I haven't got time to get to all of them, Nick, but thanks for an intriguing email there. Going back to the programme before that on whether the Catholic Church is a force for good or evil, you may remember we had Andrew Copson of the British Humanist Association and Peter D. Williams, who's a young Catholic convert. Peter Byram, another former guest on this programme, says, I must say, Peter Williams put up a spirited defence of the Catholic Church, but there were many, many moments when I was left either scratching my head or outright face-palming. In the interest of time, I'll keep my objections to a trinity. Firstly, I appreciate Peter was arguing with an atheist humanist, but so much time was wasted on the moral argument that without God we cannot call things good or evil in the first place. What totally escaped him is that this argument in the context is irrelevant, even if we accepted it and concluded there must be a God, even going so far as to affirm the Christian God, the Catholic God, as a specific institutionalised denomination. The Catholic Church could still not be a force for good in objective terms. Secondly, on the subject of condoms, Peter completely refuted himself without even realising it. He cited Uganda's ABC scheme, abstinence, be faithful and the correct use of condoms, as the most effective initiative against the spread of AIDS in Africa. Yes, that's the whole point. I must quote Stephen Fry, who brought up Uganda in that original IQ squared debate, saying, I'm not denying that abstinence is an extremely effective way of not getting AIDS. It really does work, and so does being faithful,
but so do condoms. Has Peter not put two and two together on this one yet? And finally, your third point here, Peter. You say, last of all, I really was hoping he wouldn't do this, but sure enough, Peter appealed to the fall when it came to discussing the subject of child abuse in the church, as I had the privilege of exploring that with you on your show, Justin. Such a reference only serves to complicate the issue a million times further. I can't imagine a defence lawyer representing a priest in court approaching the judge and saying, well, Your Honour, what we all have to remember is that we live in a fallen world. Nobody is going to respond with, ah, of course, I forgot, it all makes sense now. Of course, Peter was passionately vocal in his condemning of the abuse, but again, so was Stephen Fry, so was your humanist guest, and so are plenty of other non-Catholics. Thank you very much. You finish up by saying, Peter, I want to hear what good the Catholic Church specifically, not just Christianity in general, can give us, which cannot come from anywhere else. At the moment, some very impressive paintings and incantations aside, I'm stuck for an example. Thank you for the email, Peter, and do keep in touch. Jim Thompson, let's go to a completely different show. You're listening in Hobart in Australia. You say you really enjoyed the last show on the question of the soul and whether we are just a physical body or whether there is an immaterial soul. Had an interesting programme about a month ago now on that subject. You say, if we are living in a world that we accept was created by a God who is behind all physical laws and human physiology, then there may be a case for a physiologically based explanation for a soul. After your show, I don't actually find the physicalist position so out there. And I should just interject, say the physicalist position is this idea that, and it can, there is a, if you like, a Christian brand of physicalism that we don't have an immaterial soul. We are just a physical body. But if you like, God still works through the physical. My main interest, you say, Jim, after hearing countless apologist-atheist debates, is worldview. We often hear this term in debates as a natural endpoint and a stalemate for an argument. We end up at a short circuit which states that an individual's worldview determines their position. And that's all we can say about that. It seems the elephant in the room is surely the Holy Spirit. I actually wonder if apologists, and I've been guilty of this, actually put worldview ahead of the Holy Spirit in their hierarchy of factors leading to belief. Perhaps it's too embarrassing to talk about the Holy Spirit in an apologetic context, but I can't see how we can get past the worldview impasse in conversing with non-believers otherwise. I think that the Holy Spirit actually determines worldview rather than the other way round. This would be structurally this would be a structurally sound view, as it gives God the glory for our conversion and then subsequent worldview. Well, that obviously sounds like a very Calvinist point of view that you're espousing there, Jim, which many people would agree with. But there are Christians, obviously, who wouldn't, who would feel that if you like, there is a decision that's made, and then it's our it's our free will which allows the Holy Spirit to then come in, rather than the other way around. But anyway, you finished up saying, I am wondering, how can we introduce the Holy Spirit in apologetics? Or is there any scientific comment on this? Perhaps we get rooted back to presuppositional apologetics, but I do wonder if there is a way it can be brought into debate. Thank you, Jim. It's an interesting one. I mean, ultimately, of course, every Christian who's debating intellectually with it, you know, the intellectual arguments, also has a spiritual belief in the Holy Spirit. But it is very hard, in a sense, to bring that into the intellectual sphere where, you know, it's difficult, you know, to argue in terms of fact about something that is a faith position, even if we may have facts that back up the belief that the Holy Spirit is true. But so thanks for getting in touch. Okay, here's something different. Tom Pacheco in Orange County, California. Thanks for listening to the programme, Tom. You had a very quick email here asking, Justin, how do you remain committed to the faith? I assume you are a Christian. Given the many opportunities to raise doubt based on the arguments from your many guests, how is it that you can stay committed to the faith? Well, in answer to that, Thomas, I'd say that in all the years of doing this programme, there have been occasions when an argument has been presented by an atheist or someone from another faith that has really had me stumped or wondering, particularly in the early days of the programme. But what I've found in my experience is it hasn't been long before I've heard a counter-argument for Christianity that also seems very persuasive. Now, having done this programme, it's going to be coming up to 5 years at the end of this year. I think I have heard just about every argument out there in some form or another. And on balance, I still feel that the case for Christianity is intellectually very strong. And in another sense, I feel that it's also about the story that Christianity tells. I find of all the world views that I've seen and encountered, Christianity for me is still the most hopeful, the most effective, seems to have the most ability to change the world.
But then you obviously at some point have to say, well, there's an intellectual basis, but my own faith, and as you've guessed, I am a Christian. I work for a Christian radio station, after all. It's more than just believing that on balance, the intellectual arguments for Christianity are sound. And I wouldn't recommend anyone to base their faith simply on that. But I'd say that when I committed my life to Christ, I experienced something very subjective, what I would describe as the inner witness of the Holy Spirit. And I'd say that's never left me. But thank you for your email. And I do hope you might want to raise those kinds of questions on our Premier community as well. It's the kind of place where people enjoy talking about those kinds of issues. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can click through there. Oh, I think I'm out of time, and I had a few more here that I wanted to get through, but we'll have to save them over till next week. Thanks for listening today. As I say, don't forget, go check out the Unbelievable webpage now for more details about that Behe event I've been talking about in the latter part of this programme. premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and you can get yourself tickets for that event. Let others know if you think they'd be interested in coming along as well. For the meantime, all that remains is to say thank you for listening, and do tune in again at the same time next week. Let me tell you what's coming on then.
You're unbelievable.
Well, next week on the show, we're going to be having another crack at the issue of Hawking's God and the Universe. Stephen Hawking, of course, made headlines around the world with his statements about M-theory, and that he believes this has proved that God is redundant. The universe can and will create itself from nothing is one of the phrases that has been bandied around a lot. But after our programme of a couple of weeks ago with Alistair McGrath and Roger Penrose, we're wanting another crack of the whip for your questions and comments. So if you've got them, you can continue to add them at the Unbelievable group of the Premier community, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can also email them in to me as well. I'll be joined next week by John Polkinghorne, a Christian physicist from Cambridge, Hugh Ross, a Christian physicist from out in the States, and Nikolai Segura, who is an atheist scientist. Find out what they say to the whole issue of Stephen Hawking and his view of the universe, and what responses they have to your philosophical, scientific questions on next week's show. Do hope you can join me for that, as usual, here on Premier Christian Radio and on Unbelievable online, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Till then, have a great week.